This podcast is a presentation of University of California Television. Like what you hear? Consider making a donation at uctv.tv/donate so we can continue to bring you more great programs.
Pivot to a specific condition, Rett syndrome, which affects all body movement, including speech. Dr. Jennifer Martel Tu is the director of Katie's Clinic for Rett Syndrome and associate professor of neurology at UCSF Children's Hospital, Oakland. She has a special interest in movement disorders and in behavioral responses related to neurological disorders. Her research focuses on improving patients' quality of care and safety during treatment, and she will update us today on the care for children with Rett syndrome. Welcome, Dr. Martel Tu.
Hello, good afternoon. Thank you for that introduction. Let me share my slides. So I'm really excited to be a part of this conference, and really I appreciate the invitation. It's really humbling to get to talk about something I'm really passionate about. And I'm so excited to follow up after the good talks we've had so far this afternoon, because certainly with Rett syndrome, we see a lot of similar issues, and it's nice to see so many people in the field that are working with the same concerns and helping advocate for these families and patients and helping them communicate. All right, so today, just like Dr. Takayama said, I'm gonna focus on Rett syndrome and try and get through these slides relatively quickly, because I really wanna focus on some of the emerging and exciting new therapeutics for Rett syndrome. Okay. So my disclosures, I did participate this past year in a post-market advisory panel with Acadia, which is the company that manufactures and has done all the research with the new pharmaceutical debut or trofinetide. So today we'll start with just a brief overview of what Rett syndrome is, kind of what it looks like, its typical presentation, how it's diagnosed, and then I will touch on management options, trying to break it down between both pharmacological strategies and non-pharmacologic strategies, and hopefully spend more of the time at the end talking about new therapeutics. So what is Rett syndrome? This is a developmental encephalopathy, meaning that there's a difference in how patients interact with their environment and how they express themselves and communicate and kind of show their engagement with the environment. That's basically what encephalopathy means. It's due to a mutation in the MECP2 gene, which is located on the X chromosome. Because of that, it's primarily a condition seen in girls, although there is a even more rare condition where Rett syndrome can be present in boys as well. This protein, the methyl CpG binding protein 2, MECP2 for short, it helps to maintain communication between nerve cells, which is primarily why we see it as a neurodevelopmental disorder. But it also has significant impact throughout the body, which is part of the reason why we see dysfunction in multiple organ systems, not just within the brain. It has many associated comorbidities, as I'll describe in a bit. And really, because it's a genetic mutation, there's lots of possibilities for how this protein and gene can be affected. And due to those multiple possibilities, this is a condition with a broad spectrum of what is possible clinically and the symptoms that we see based on where the mutations are and what changes there are genetically. So typically, these patients, unfortunately, there's no prenatal sign. There's no warning sign that helps families seek care earlier. There's really nothing that can be done, and they have a normal pregnancy for the most part, normal delivery. And it's not until later in infancy when we see concerning signs. Typically, they have normal development for the first 6 to 18 months. And then after that point, there's a regression or a loss of skills. Primarily, the skills that are lost are in communication and in fine motor skills, so purposeful hand movements, but really all domains of development can be impacted. They classically have these hand stereotypies where the hands are often clasped together. There's tapping behaviors, hand wringing behaviors, and often hand mouthing where the fingers go to the mouth and they chew on their fingers. Not every child has those, certainly, but that is classically what we see in these patients. And after that regression phase, the children enter a plateau phase for their development, and they definitely can acquire new skills. They can learn. It's not that this is a progressive degenerative disorder, but it does affect development. So we see that regression, but we know that these children can gain new skills. We do have clinical criteria. I mean, this is a condition that has been known and well described for about 50 years. So we definitely know enough historically about these patients to say this is the clinical criteria. This is what we use to diagnose this. Because when this was first described, we did not have access to the genetics. It was really descriptive criteria that were used. So like I mentioned in the last slide, development on track, typically between age 6 to 18 months, we start to see a loss of skills. Classically, it's in fine motor skills, speech, and some gait abnormalities. They stabilize after a period of regression, and then they have improvements where they can learn. But unfortunately, throughout their lifetime, we do see a gradual slowing of motor skills and a bit of sort of Parkinson features later in life. This is a genetic condition. So it's confirmed with genetic testing now. Initially, it was not confirmed because we didn't have access, but now we do. And what's striking is that there are over 200 variants described. There could be any spontaneous mutation, but to date, we have over 200 variants in this gene that have been described. And uniquely, about 70% of those fall within 8 well-known missense or nonsense variants. So we certainly can see any imaginable change genetically that could lead to a pathologic variant, but most of the cases fall within 8 typically described mutations. You can get this diagnosis through single gene or panel testing. There are a couple companies out there that offer most commonly Angelman and Rett syndrome as a combined assay. It's sometimes picked up on a chromosomal microarray, depending on the nature of the genetic change, and often it's picked up on a whole exome sequence. I put two other conditions that are related to Rett syndrome because of their clinical significance and their genetic similarities. So that's the CDKL5 and FOXG1 mutations. So in our clinic, in the Rett syndrome clinic, we will see patients with those genetic changes as well, because phenotypically they're very similar to our Rett patients. The other diagnostic testing we often do are an EEG and a brain MRI. And that's often because when you have a child with developmental delay and you haven't confirmed genetically yet, we're looking for any clues that might help us understand this patient. And so an EEG and a brain MRI from the neurology perspective are just common tests that we also obtain. So moving on to the management piece here, and I apologize if I'm going a little quickly, but I really do want to get through to the end. Management for these patients, I like this picture because it's friendly, it's good colors, but really it's just to emphasize that it does take a village. There's so much going on with these patients, both medically, socially, in the community, in the school system, many different body systems that are involved. And so it really takes a strong team to take care of these patients. And I'm going to highlight some of the non-pharmacologic and pharmacologic methods that are used for patients with Rett syndrome. So the basic tenets I like to point out, especially the first time I meet families, trying to introduce them to the way that we work in our clinic, we really want to see patients in a multidisciplinary clinic. And this is because we know there are so many body systems involved, and we know that there's so many pieces outside of medicine that are important, the social pieces, the school pieces, supports in the home, medical devices, all of those things. It's really important to have that multidisciplinary setting to make sure that nothing is falling through the cracks and these patients are getting the supports that they deserve. I do like to point out that there is there are clinical guidelines available. These are consensus guidelines. The sort of experts in this field have all worked together for many years, and the directors for the centers of excellence throughout the country, we meet frequently to go over these. And just recently, within the last year, we've updated the guidelines. Really, they're there for the pediatricians out there, for families out there, just to know what sort of surveillance is recommended, how often do they need to have an EKG, all of those sorts of questions are covered in the clinical guidelines. And so it's just a resource that we've put out to make sure that families and caregivers are aware of what should be done. The other thing to remember is that your child at 6 months is going to look very different than your child at age 40. The challenges that we see, the comorbidities that we see do evolve over the lifespan. And so the care that you get is going to be different, and the team members that you're seeing are going to be different depending on the age of the patient. And then lastly, re-emphasizing that because there are so many complexities with these patients, that the team approach really, really is required. And there's multiple specialties involved. We all work together. And the best way to do that, circling back to number one, is making sure you're in the right dedicated clinic space to really make sure you're getting the team members that you need. As for the primary care guidelines, these are the general categories that are covered in those guidelines. And it should be available in the syllabus slides as, and this can be shared with anyone, but there's a specific website you can go to download. It's a PDF that covers all of these areas because these are the majority or the primary conditions or concerns that we have for our patients. We talk about growth and development all the way through hospitalization concerns, social concerns, you know, what to do about certain rashes, all that sort of stuff. So it's a really nice document put together for primary care and for the families. This is just a single slide alphabetical, and you see this only goes through N, just to highlight the number of comorbidities and issues that we can see. Certainly cardiology, the biggest risk that we're worried about is what we call prolonged QT syndrome, and that can affect, you know, any medications that they might need. Do they need surgery and anesthesia? It can really impact many aspects of your life. And so just an example of the surveillance that we have to do, these girls get an EKG or these patients get an EKG every year monitoring for prolonged QT syndrome. And then other common ones we see, the GI system is significantly impacted for these patients. The respiratory system is significantly impacted. And then neurology, that's my specialty. So I'm certainly gonna spend a little bit of time on that. We see the delays initially, there's muscle tone abnormalities, there's seizures are very common, behavioral dysregulation is very common. So it's certainly many, many concerns. This is why we need a multi-specialty team approach. All right, not to reiterate this point just one more time, multiple team members, it varies throughout the life. So jumping into the actual management strategies for the non-pharmacologic side, this is where the bulk of our management is really spent, because there are so many things that are really don't need medication but can't be ignored. So for interventional services, this is really where we spend a lot of our time advocating for our patients. We want them to have physical therapy, occupational therapy, and tacking on to the last presentation, speech therapy is super important for our patients. They are non-speakers, but that doesn't mean they're not communicators. Many of our patients, because they don't have the fine motor skills, can't use PECs or spelling boards or other types of traditional AAC. So they most preferentially use gaze tracking devices. But again, this is a spectrum condition, and some of our patients do have some hand control and can use other forms of augmented communication devices. We certainly focus on family and caregiver considerations as well, because this is a condition that is very high special needs and the family can be significantly impacted. And we want to make sure that we're not ignoring that, because a healthy family leads to a healthy child. So we want to make sure we're addressing all of those concerns. One of the ones that I will point out, I think, is common that we see for many patients with developmental disabilities is that, yes, it starts as a child, but they also grow up into adults. And the concern is that, what if your child outlives you, or, you know, it survives beyond the point where parents can assist? And so one of the things we often help with in that transition is the guardianship process. It's a challenging process because it's a court legal process as well as a medical process. And so we can help families kind of navigate that situation. So the resources that we use most often here in California are going to be the regional center to begin with. Now, this is typically eligible for patients from 0 to age 3 years. And so those who have developmental disabilities, developmental delay, they will typically qualify for services through the regional center. So getting physical therapy and occupational therapy may actually be easier early on than it is once they age out of this. They often age out around age after age three, but there are some unique things for provisional eligibility that many of our patients will qualify for. And so we often work with our social work team when we're in clinic to make sure that we're getting the right forms filled out and all the medical documentation that's needed to make sure our patients qualify with the regional center as long as possible. And then there are children and adults with permanent disabilities who qualify through adulthood for the regional center. And for this, typically we're looking for patients that have specific diagnostic conditions, and Rett syndrome is a qualifying diagnosis, but there are some challenges because there must be additional diagnoses or symptoms that are met as well. And this is part of the reason, again, why it's important to be in a specific clinic for Rett syndrome, because we can help with all that paperwork. The regional center also offers something called self-determination. And for those of you out there that do anything working with the regional center or have other patients for not just Rett syndrome, but any other condition, I would encourage anyone to apply for the self-determination portion of the regional center services, because it allows the family to decide how they want to use their dollars or funds that the regional center allocates to them. It makes it easier for my patients to get in to see the dentist that they want to, or have other services that might be more challenging to get. Sometimes things like obtaining a sleep-safe bed is easier to get when you have self-determination. And then lastly, the medical therapy units are a division under the regional center. And I think I'll go into that a little bit later. So regional center can offer lots of resources for families. They've got the infant development services from age 0 to 5. They do durable medical equipment, which is really important for our patients. They have often scoliosis or spasticity, other motor concerns. They may be non-ambulatory or cannot walk for long distances, so they need chairs and strollers that are adaptive. And that's part of the things that the regional center can help provide for families. And then the nice thing that regional center also offers is something called respite services. In our area, we often use a George Marks House. It's a phenomenal center. If anyone's not familiar with it, I encourage you to just Google it, George Marks. They offer overnight care for patients with qualifying diagnoses. So if you have the regional center services, and that way, especially for families where there's multiple children, it allows for the child with special needs to stay in a loving and well allocated center overnight. And the family can then have dedicated one-on-one time with their other children, or you know, whatever their needs are, but it's a really wonderful service. And so that's something that the regional center can provide. So just a list here of what's available through the regional center. The next step up from regional center is going to be the CCS, or California Children's Services. And this one can be a tricky one to navigate. It's really crucial though. So again, not just Rett syndrome, but most patients with special needs, this is something that we really, really strive to get provided for our families, and a lot of social supports that are eligible here. The tricky thing about CCS is that there are 18 different categories that are qualifying categories for CCS. And so they're very, the website for CCS is very specific, but at the same time, relatively vague in how it's worded of what's a qualifying diagnosis. And so this is why, unfortunately, it can often be a trial and error process. So if you don't get it the first time, we encourage our families to apply again. We provide additional documentation. And it's not to point fingers. I mean, in any governmental agency, they're doing their best. They're serving their patients as best they can, but they really need to make sure that they're meeting the right criteria. And so sometimes it really just is a little bit of a back and forth and making sure that we've got the documentation and clear diagnoses that they can then qualify for CCS. What we typically use for Rett syndrome is under the diseases of the nervous system. Our patients not only have Rett syndrome, but they often meet criteria for cerebral palsy based on their tone abnormalities. They often have hypotonia or spasticity. Many of our patients have a seizure disorder. And those two things or individual things in addition to Rett syndrome would be qualifying diagnoses. And then similar to what was described in the last conversation or the last talk about apraxia as far as communication goes, many of our girls have motor apraxia. I'm sorry, I shouldn't say girls. Many of our patients have motor apraxia or ataxia. These are different things, but often fall under kind of the similar pathway in your motor control. And so again, another way to qualify for CCS. The other thing that many of our patients with Rett syndrome would qualify under would be scoliosis. Our patients often end up with neuromuscular scoliosis. And if your degree is greater than, if your curvature is greater than 20 degrees, then that's another way to qualify for CCS. There's some other ones listed here. The benefits of CCS, which can be really, really helpful for families. It's another source of funds for families to pay for, you know, medical needs, surgeries, hospital stays, medical equipment, similar to regional center, again, just another level of care. And then the next step, another resource that we look for is your Medi-Cal eligibility. In California, this is, you know, specific to California, but it's a relatively straightforward application process. You need to have documentation from your treatment care team. They're often looking for Rett syndrome. They want to hear from your neurologist. So I often fill out a lot of these forms to help families qualify here. And again, just a list of the resources that is available through your Medi-Cal benefits. And the last one I want to touch on for resources that I think are really helpful for families with disabilities and specifically for our Rett syndrome patients is IHSS. And this is just a level of financial support when we have caregivers who are providing the in-home medical care, right? Oftentimes the care is 24 hours and that prevents one of the caregivers from being able to join the workforce. And in that case, IHSS provides financial support and recognizes that they're doing a medical job. They're taking care of this patient rather than having them go into a group home setting or some other medical facility setting. They're providing care at home and that should be recognized. And so you can qualify for a number of hours of support, which is just financial support for the family. The last piece of IHSS is going to be your protective supervision. I think protective supervision is something that's really, really important for any child with a disability that needs that 24-hour supervision. And so for our patients with Rett syndrome, many of them are mobile enough to get out of bed in the middle of the night. And unfortunately, they have irregular sleep patterns. And so they're awake at odd hours. And unless they have a sleep-safe setting where they have a tent bed or some other restraint keeping them in the bed, they can get out and wander, and they don't have the awareness to not be at risk for self-harm. And so for our patients, it's really easy to argue the need for the protective supervision. But for any patient really that qualifies for IHSS, it's just sort of the next level of care and should be something that should be considered. It's an application process. It does go through sort of a legal process as well because of the criteria are a little bit on the legal side as well as the medical side. So it is a bit of an application process, but I think the benefits are certainly there and are really, really super beneficial for the families to have. Social Security is just another one to remember because, again, we focus on children because that's where these issues start, but they do grow up into adults. And so it's important to remember there's another level of resources and support that's available. All right, that's moving from sort of governmental programs and especially those specific to California. The last piece for our patients is the school system, because again, a lot of these things for our patients are not medical. They don't need medications, but they still need the supports. And so we're doing a lot of individual education plans. We're doing school-based physical therapy, occupational therapy, and for especially for our regional center patients or for those that qualify for special education. In California, that's from newborn age all the way to age 22. And so making sure that our parents are aware of what's available and what they what is justified and what these patients do qualify and deserve in the school system. The last piece of non-pharmacologic management for our patients is going to be equipment. I touched on this briefly when I was going over regional center and CCS coverage, because that's how we get most of our devices and equipment for our patients. For Rett syndrome specifically, a lot of it focuses on mobility and safety. I think those are the two easiest ways to break down the equipment needs. For mobility, it's often bracing. AFOs and SMOs are very, very common. We like for our patients to be ambulatory as long as possible. And there's often a delay in learning to walk. While many of our patients are not actually walking until after the age of 3 or 4. And so during that transition time, we want to make sure they have access to a stander, they have gait trainers, they have strollers and wheelchairs to really assist in their mobility and maintain their mobility throughout their lifetime. And then for safety, I mentioned a couple of these already, but some of the classic ones are going to be car seats that are not just your traditional toddler in a car seat, but you know, we've got teenagers and adults who need safe riding restraints in the car. And so there's definitely adaptive equipment there. Activity chairs, lifts for the families, because these children do not stay small forever. And we don't want our parents hurting them, their backs, or getting injuries because they're trying to position their children. So lifts are certainly important. And then the tent beds or sleep safe beds are another common one. All right, so that moves us from the non-pharmacologic into the pharmacologic, and this is where we're going to stay for the rest of the talk. I mentioned at the very beginning that for Rett syndrome, there's really a broad spectrum of what we see, not just in developmental abilities and in their motor skills, but also in their medical conditions. Seizures are incredibly common in Rett syndrome, but not every patient with Rett syndrome has seizures. And the same can be said for almost every organ system. I think the most common things are going to be seizures, GI motility dysfunction, and respiratory dysfunction, I think are the most common things we see, but every organ system can be impacted. These are also covered in the clinical guidelines that are available on the website that I pointed out earlier. But most of the medications we use target the common things. So GERD, incredibly common. So acid reflux, it often presents with spitting up, pain, grimacing after eating, not wanting to feed well. These children can't tell you what's happening. And so families often have to watch out for the signs of it. And we go over that in clinic. So it's commonly spit ups and pain are what we're looking for. And so most of our patients are going to be on a PPI or an H2 blocker, but more commonly a PPI, at least for some extended period of time, often from early infancy to toddler age. Some patients do outgrow this, but it can be a lifelong issue. For epilepsy and seizures, there are many, many seizure medications to consider, and all seizure types have been described in Rett syndrome. So focal seizures, generalized seizures, syndromes such as Lennox-Gastaut, where you have multiple seizure types, all of those are possible in Rett syndrome. And then with epilepsy and these anti-seizure medications, it's sort of a double-edged sword, because our patients already have issues with osteoporosis and bone health and vitamin D levels. And we know many of our seizure medications have a risk of osteoporosis. So just one extra thing we have to keep in consideration for these families. For breathing dysregulation, medications like buspirone and topiramate have been tried, but there's until recently, there's relatively limited positive studies showing significant improvements with medications. We have most of our patients followed by a nutritionist. So we monitor their growth, we monitor their nutrition. They're often on calcium or vitamin D supplementation. We see lots of sleep disturbance. I mentioned the need for sleep safe beds or sleep safe settings or rooms because they often have odd hours of sleep. They may not sleep the whole night through. They're often awake for several hours in the middle of the night. So we utilize medications like melatonin, trazodone, most commonly for sleep disorders. And then constipation, this will come up in the next couple of slides as I talk about one of the newer medications, but constipation is a really, really common problem with Rett syndrome. And constipation can lead to a lot of behavioral dysregulation and reductions in communication efficacy. So we really focus on having a standard bowel regimen, making sure that we're not running into issues with constipation. And then lastly, anxiety. We often use SSRIs for these patients. Again, this may be something that's present early on that they may sort of outgrow, but it's certainly possible throughout their lifespan to have some anxiety. And SSRIs have been shown to be quite helpful in this patient population. So the things to consider for any of the medications that we use, we know that our patients are very sensitive to side effects. Even low dosing, we can see behavioral changes, we can see irritability, it can affect their GI tract, they can end up with constipation or more acid reflux. And so with the side effects, we're very careful about our dosing. The other thing to consider is that QT prolongation that I mentioned early on in the talk. Because of that, we have to really review the medications that we're using and make sure that they're not at risk for further QT prolongation. I mentioned with the seizure medications, the concern about osteoporosis. And then route of administration is an important one because many of our patients, while they do take in oral nutrition, they often have G-tubes. They may not be able to swallow without some degree of dysphagia. And so we often have to consider how we're giving these medications to make sure they're appropriate. So our general mantra for families is to start low and go slow. So it takes a long time to often get to the therapeutic dose for medications that we're using because we're trying to minimize side effects. We're trying to work with route of administration, and we're really working with families to make sure that things are tolerated before we advance. When we're talking about any medication or any therapeutic for our patients, one of the things that we often will review with families is kind of this quality of life question. If something is not dangerous, just because it has the word benign, doesn't mean it's not affecting their quality of life. And so when we're deciding whether to allow a symptom to continue versus trial a medication, we're often really performing this balancing act. And a lot of it is trial and error. And a lot of times families feel like their child is a guinea pig because we're just throwing things out there. But we really do want to consider side effects, potential benefit for the family. Is this something that needs to be treated? Is it distressing, even if it's not dangerous? And so we're really, really having these conversations frequently with our families, trying to make sure we're doing the right thing, right? We want to make sure we're keeping the body strong, that we're advancing their development as much as possible. We're advocating for their safety. We're advocating for their comfort. And we're really making sure that we're again, keeping their goals in line with the therapeutic goals. All right, so that's everything to date. What I want to focus on next are the exciting new things that are coming down the pipeline and have recently been released for Rett syndrome. And the first one I'm very excited about is the medication is called Daybue. And it's Daybue because this is the first medication that has been approved with a specific indication of Rett syndrome. It's been a long time coming, and I know our community is super excited that we're getting the attention that these patients deserve. And we're seeing more and more pharmaceutical companies and startup gene therapies, all sorts of things really focusing on Rett syndrome. And it's just fascinating. So Daybue, or trofinetide, it's been on the market for about a year now. And I think we have about 20% of our patients so far that have tried it. And that's just a matter of the approval process. So it's going to go up. This is a liquid medication that was approved for patients with Rett syndrome, age 2 years and older. Got its FDA approval in March of 2023. It's given twice a day, and it is dosed according to the patient's weight. This is not a technically disease-modifying agent. So once it's given, if we're seeing positive effects, in order to continue to have those positive effects, it would need to be continued to be administered. So it's something that is sort of a daily medication taken in the morning and the evening. It can be given orally or through the G-tube. And for those that have GJ tubes, it's given through the G-port. There are some precautions and concerns that are related to this medication, primarily the strawberry allergy, because it is a strawberry-flavored solution, and then diarrhea and weight loss. And I will talk a little bit about those in just a second. The interactions are, it's primarily metabolized by the liver, so you've got some standard interactions there. And what we saw, what was seen in the clinical trials before the FDA approval, was improvements in social communication domains, fine motor skills, and respiratory status. And I'm going to share a few examples of what we've seen just in our clinic here. And I know nationally there's been similar stories that people are sharing. So as far as the diarrhea and the weight loss concern, I mentioned a few slides ago that constipation is a major concern for our patients with Rett syndrome. And then you have to balance a medication that on the opposite spectrum can cause diarrhea. And when these trials were first conducted, you know, there was not a lot that could be done to manage the diarrhea initially. And so, for example, if you had a patient who was in a trial, you don't want to change the medications they're on before the trial, because then it just confuses the effect and how you measure it. And so a lot of times these patients were continued on their bowel regimen, and then they were started on a medication that can cause diarrhea. And then you're sort of backtracking how to address the diarrhea when, if you had been proactive, which we can be now, you might not have had as much of a concern. And so for our patients now, even though there's this risk of diarrhea, the fact that we know this and we can change their bowel regimen and start at a low dose, we've actually not been seeing diarrhea as a major issue recently with how we're counseling families on how to administer this medication. So it's definitely still a concern. We watch for it. We're very careful about any side effects, just like with any medication. But I think we've gotten a much better handle on how to address the side effects and concerns with Daybue the more we've learned about it. Now, this is it's a very exciting medication, and I get a little emotional when I talk about what we've seen with our patients, because it's one of those things where quality of life and your experiences are, you can never tell someone what's significant, and what they can measure in a trial with scales and, you know, yes or no questionnaires and all those things, it just doesn't always come across the same way as the personal stories that families share. And one of the ones that has been most touching for me is we have a patient who's, you know, in her 20s, and she started the medication, and within about 2 months, her mom shared that she actually reached out and held her hand for the first time in probably 15 years. And it was intentional, and it's been reproduced. And you can't tell me that that's not a significant change for this patient. It's showing the social connection, the communication is there, and it's powerful. And so we're just thrilled that we've got a medication now that we can use. The hard part is that you're not going to see the same effect for every patient. As I've mentioned multiple times, this is a condition with a spectrum of what we see clinically. And so what's meaningful or what's a significant change for one patient is going to be very different for other patients. in the majority of our patients that have started this medication, we are seeing improvements in their focus and attention. So if they're a child who's using a communication device, their responses are more reliable. They're initiating communication a bit more readily. We're seeing improvements in fine motor skills. I have a couple patients who have some retained hand function, and they're now opening doors. And while that presents new challenges for the family as far as safety concerns, you know, it's significant as far as this child's mobility and independence. And so we're just very excited about this medication, and we're optimistic that this won't be the only one that we'll see more in the future. So that's DAYBUE in a nutshell. And like I said, we're excited about it. I can't wait to see what happens in the future. And it's something that we are continuing to sort of modify how we counsel families based on the more we learn about it. The next one I'll go over just really quickly, and then I think that should be the end, is the challenges of gene therapy, because this is a new emerging thing. For Rett syndrome specifically, the challenge is how to get it to the brain, so the delivery mechanism. And then for Rett syndrome, this is MECP2 deletion or reduction in protein. Unfortunately, there is a similar condition called MECP2 duplication syndrome. So that we know for this protein, too much or too little are both a problem. And so for gene therapies, it's really challenging to deliver this protein in a way that's not overexpressed, but you have to get it to a certain level that it makes a change. And there are two current therapies in study right now. Both of them had very, very exciting preclinical data in both mouse and non-human primates. And they are now in the human phases, and they are administering to test subjects. And so both Taysha and Neurogene have dosed multiple patients. None of the results are available yet, but we're keeping our fingers crossed that no news is good news, because we've not gotten any concerning releases about safety. And so we're optimistic that these are going to continue to move forward. And based on the preclinical data, we're just very excited. And that's it for Rett syndrome. I wanted to put out here just how to refer to the Rett clinic, both external and internal referrals. And again, these should be available in the syllabus. And then for UCSF in general, it's just a nice contact slide for everyone.
Dr. Martell, too, thank you so much for such a comprehensive discussion, including that of the new medications. And some of the resources that you discussed are applicable to so many patients. So the first question is a general one, which is, how do you interface with both primary care as well as subspecialty clinicians who all have their own areas of expertise but may not know as much as you do about Rett syndrome?
Yeah, it's a great question. So when you refer a patient to Rett clinic, they're going to be seen by a panel of providers, but we know that these patients are best cared for locally. And so we really take it upon ourselves to reach back out to the referring provider, to their local neurologist, to their local pediatrician, their local speech therapist. And so we write letters after each of our visits, and those will get sent back to the primaries in their local community.
Thank you. Then there's a question about boys and men with Rett syndrome. Are there any boys and men with Rett syndrome? What about gender identification or transgender?
So there are definitely boys that have Rett syndrome. They tend to be a bit more severely impacted, but that's, again, spectrum disorder. And so we have a few patients that we've seen over the years, a few boys that we've seen over the years, and nationally, I know in several other centers, there are boys that have been seen in our in the centers of excellences across the country. As far as gender identity, it's a really challenging question. I think it's unique, not just to, you know, Rett syndrome or any other condition, but it's challenging because these patients have limited communication abilities, and it's not something that we often delve into. Their identity, right, as a person is really challenging to uncover. They certainly all have their unique personalities and things that they like, but it's not often brought up in a meaningful way. But for those patients that can communicate, we certainly do focus on a lot of their interpersonal skills and social communication skills. So I don't know if there's, if the question is looking at the relationship between X expression and gender identity or down that route, but I am not personally aware of any transgender patients with Rett syndrome, but does not mean it's not possible.
The next question is about the medication, the trofinetide, and basically, how does that work?
It's a great question. So roundabout sort of short explanation is that it targets insulin-like growth factor, that pathway, and that helps to sort of create stability in the neurons. Part of the problem with Rett syndrome is that we our tree of neurons and connected is pruned, so there's fewer connections. And if we can promote longevity and survivorship of the neurons, then we can have better connections. And so that just the signaling pathways are strengthened. And basically that the pathway that's targeted by this medication promotes neuronal survival.
So better communication between the neurons. Okay.
Correct.
What about anesthesia risk in children with Rett syndrome?
That is an excellent question. And so it really depends on the comorbidities. So for patients that have prolonged QT syndrome, it should be known, and there are safe medications and anesthetics that can be used in that context. That's why we monitor for it and look for it. Prior to any surgical procedure, the patient should be getting an EKG. As far as concerns like seizures or other comorbidities, it depends on the medications they're on. And so for most of our patients, prior to having any surgical procedure, we go through medications with anesthesia to make sure we have a safe plan.
Oh, great. Thank you. And I think the last question has to do with growth. Any advice or target on BMI or weight for height for patients with Rett's or average percentile Rett growth chart?
So there is a Rett growth chart. It's not a it's not through like the NIH or the CDC, but if you go to the International Rett Syndrome Foundation or you look at the clinical care guidelines, there are specific Rett growth parameters. Many of our patients would technically be in the failure to thrive category just based on their weight and height. They do have a reduction in their growth. But they often fall within BMIs typically in the teenage years are going to be anywhere from 10 to 15 on the standard curves. But there are Rett specific parameters that we're looking for.
Well, thank you so much for everything in your talk. And
it was my pleasure. This was great.
You've been listening to a podcast by University of California Television. For more information about this program or UCTV, visit us online at uctv.tv.